Can we establish unifying principles on data quality in metabolomics? What pushes scientists to share years of work openly with the community? And how does industry contribute to the way that we do science? These are just a few of the questions we address in this episode of The Metabolomist with my guest, Matthew Lewis. Welcome to Season 5 of the Metabolomist podcast, where we dive into the communities that are transformed by metabolomics. I am your host, Alice Limonciel, and this year I will engage with scientists who not only use metabolomics, but who leverage it for the greater good. People who know that metabolomics is a tool that holds the promise of transforming our society, but who also understand that to deliver on that promise, metabolomics needs to be part of something greater. Projects, networks, infrastructures, they all form around a common goal and make use of the best tools at their disposal. So this year in the podcast, I talk to passionate people who build communities through any strategy, from grassroots movements to decades of networking. Join me to discover the creations of these community builders and how metabolomics is helping them advance their mission. Welcome back to The Metabolomist. Today, I am joined by Matthew Lewis, or Matt Lewis, as he is known by most people in the community. Hi, Matt.
Hello.
So I'm really happy to welcome you on the podcast. One reason is because we now work together for a few months, and I've had the pleasure of talking about metabolomics and about science with you. And I thought it would be great for the podcast that we share some of those discussions we have with the audience. As usual, I would like to begin with a bit of an overview of your career and where you come from and how you got acquainted with metabolomics. Can you tell us a little bit? Today you work at Bruker, but how did you get there?
Sure. I was super, super lucky when I went to university initially. Very lucky that when I first started my undergraduate, I was 17, and I went door to door in the biochemistry department, basically asking who could possibly take me into their lab. And this wonderful woman, a wonderful scientist named Jennifer Nyborg, said, "You're a bit young, but come back next year, and we'll have you." You know, so I did that, and I joined her lab the next year. And got to work with her and just an absolutely super team of international scientists who I found genuinely inspiring. And in fact, all other things in my life fell away. I was supposed to play rugby and do all these other things. And I ended up just living in the lab because I loved it so much. I love the people and what we were doing. So it was a...
This was in the US, right? This was in Colorado or where?
This was at Colorado State University.
Yeah.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. I worked there for 3 years. I did a master's 1 year after that. And then after that, I was an instructor in the Department of Biochemistry. And I really love that. And in the course of the work in Jenny Nyborg's lab, we were doing a lot of chromatographic separations and purifications of protein complexes so that we could build structures for X-ray crystallography. And that ultimately led to some mass spectrometry-based work on proteins. Don't tell anyone, but my first mass spectrometry was based on proteins. And I just remember really loving how technical and how quantitative and how analytical mass spectrometry was. And ultimately, you can only do Western blots so much. And, you know, they're very, very qualitative. And after a while, that became a bit unsatisfying. I mean, don't get me wrong. I love the work and all, but the techniques were all very qualitative. And mass spectrometry was this world of like decimal places and exact measurements. And wow, it just really wowed me. I loved it very much. So when the university decided to start a metabolomics program circa 2005, 2006, under the leadership of a guy named Phil Ryan, I went for it. I thought this is really cool. Mm-hmm. And I loved metabolism from my biochemistry studies. And I thought this is the perfect culmination of background in chromatography, interest in metabolism, and this budding interest in mass spectrometry. And so went for that. And I worked alongside some really, really wonderful people and, later came to know others, who were very inspiring to work with. And then did some work for or work that I guess was picked up by Waters Corporation, which led to recruitment to Imperial College in 2010. Mm-hmm. And things just kind of went from there. That was a whole nother explosion of new people, a lot of talent, a lot of creativity, a lot of inspiration.
You were at the epicenter of this budding world of metabolomics, weren't you?
Exactly. I mean, working with Elaine Holmes, working with Jeremy Nicholson, and then from 2012 onward, working with Zoltan Tekec. I was very lucky to work with all of these great minds, all of these really excellent people, good leaders.
You also worked in one specific structure that is the National Phenome Center. Yeah. What happened there, and especially for metabolomics, lipidomics, like what was the purpose of that structure?
So the purpose was a big push into human health, specifically population health, right? And it was this joint initiative led by principally by Jeremy Nicholson, also other key stakeholders like at Professor Frank Kelly, who's now at Imperial College as well. And it was a big grant to reuse some of the instrumentation from the London 2012 Olympics, right? That was a big part of it. It was part of the Olympic legacy. And it was intended to tackle societal challenges of, you know, diseases that are majorly pressing for human health, like neurodegeneration and cardiovascular disease, and, you know, those big topics, as well as serve the really excellent local clinical community at Imperial, and then more broadly, the rest of the UK. So it was the UK National Phenome Center, and we were very proud to set that up, to establish it. And I think one of the things that always struck me about that is that we made a conscious decision not to operate at the bleeding edge of technology, right? There were other people, like, again, to reference Zoltan Tekec, who was pushing the bleeding edge of technology in the same department. I'm very lucky to work alongside him. But at the Phenome Center, we took a conscious step back from that, and we really focused on standardization, right? Mm-hmm. And so we're, I think, one of the earlier groups standing on the shoulders of other groups like HuserMet, Roy Goodacre, and Rick Dunn and others, Ian Wilson, to name a few, who were doing large-scale studies. And we really focused on what's needed for large-scale LCMS and NMR-based studies. So quality, throughput, efficiency, how to design the lab for that, how to design workflows for that. Those were all things that were very much in scope for us.
Is it right after that you started working with Bruker, or maybe there were things in between? So how did you end up moving to industry, which is for a lot of people, so either a big step that they took in their career or something that they're thinking about? So how did it happen for you?
Yeah, I mean, so going back to Colorado State, I mean, that I was in the core facility from, I think, 2006 forward. And at Imperial College, being a part of the National Phenome Center was again like a very big core facility. You could think of it in such a way, right? I think that doesn't do Jeremy Nicholson's vision justice, but you could think of it in that kind of way. So yeah. It's fair to say that there was always this one foot in this industrialized world, that with a focus on efficiency and a focus on sustainable business, that kind of thing, right? Running, everyone who runs a core facility knows how hard it is to keep the lights on, you know, make sure that the ins and the outs balance in that respect.
Yeah, that's the reality of a lot of people in the field. So for metabolomics or omics in general, core facilities have become one way to make it more accessible to more people. Just that one group does the expertise, the work, but also does the business of running this. Sorry to interrupt you.
No, not at all. You're dead on. National Phenome Center still has a very talented woman named Lynn Maslin, who oversees the business, right? So Lynn and I worked together. That was an important aspect of that. These things shouldn't be overlooked when comparing industry to academia, right? And in order to make it sustainable, we had to have someone who was business oriented and specifically putting pressure on us not to wander off in directions that wouldn't bring a reasonable return on investment, right? So I think we always had a constructive tension, Lynn and I, which was like, you know, we can do things that we think are innovative and we can spend time on those, but let's also keep it focused on on sustainable business, which is good for the people who work there, their careers and everything as well. So that was great. That was really good learning that just naturally led towards industry, I think. And I think that the tipping point for me was we were working with so many collaborators and working on so many diseases, working on so many areas of interest with so many people. I think over time, at least for me, it became almost overwhelming, right? Where in one meeting you're talking about Alzheimer's disease, and in the next meeting you're talking about cardiovascular disease, and it all, I don't want to say it all starts to look the same, because that's also not fair, but you know, some of the, like, the passions of the people that you're working with, who are super, I worked with an amazing researcher who was super passionate about diabetes and stratification of diabetes patients beyond types 1 and 2, and you see that passion, but for you, the next hour is going to be spent with someone else with an equal passion elsewhere, and you start to think, well, what's my passion, right? Why do I show up, and why is this so interesting to me? And that really gravitated towards building better methods and indeed better instruments for to support what we do, right? And that just naturally led towards industry, which over time led towards a migration over to a solutions. We call, you know, we think in terms of solutions, but an instrument manufacturer, right?
And that's how you ended up working at Bruker, where I really, like, as I hear you explain this path, it really fits also with the way that we discuss what we do on a daily basis. So it really tracks. But so it's really interesting for me, because one of the reasons why I wanted to invite you, or to, let's say, to have someone from industry, and especially from the manufacturer of some of the instruments that are used for metabolomics on the podcast, is that for me, the companies that build the tools that we use for metabolomics are part of the scientific community. And I think when you explain your path and you explain how you ended up naturally gravitating towards an instrument vendor, it makes sense. But I think it's not obvious for everyone. So communities is the topic of the podcast this year. So this is the main thing I want to address. But what do we get as a scientific community from industry that academics, you know, don't do, that is not the purpose of their work and that industry contributes?
It's a very deep question. I think for me is down to enablement, right? Mm-hmm. We really, really focus on enablement. I remember when I first came to Bruker and someone asked why are you doing this? I said, well, we drive enabling technologies. We make enabling solutions. Isn't that cool? And they laughed and said, you know, surely that's a party line. I thought, no, it's not. I was surprised by that reaction, because for me, it really is the very genuine attraction to what we're doing here. A really nice guy named Ian Wilson, Professor Ian Wilson, gave me a placard once that he used to have in his lab at AstraZeneca, and it was from Humphrey Davy. And it basically says, paraphrasing, There's no change in the scientific capabilities of people over the last 100 years, but they have access to different tools, right? And that's kind of what helps drive things. And I didn't understand it, honestly, at the time he gave it to me. I put it aside and thought, yeah, that's a neat quote. But that today, that's really core. That's really meaningful to me, right? Because we have the great privilege of designing tools which help enhance the capabilities of these very smart, wonderful, brilliant people that we're so lucky to work with or call our collaborators or our customers, right? So that for me, it's 100% enablement in that respect, right? And by enabling this next generation of analytical chemists, I mean, we can't forget that they are doing their work to enable clinicians, and they're doing their work to enable epidemiologists. So it's this kind of really rewarding chain of enablement, which helps drive impact in science. I think that's very neat.
Yeah, I fully agree. Thank you. So we chose to discuss two papers today, and I think also the topics of those papers tie really nicely into this. One is about sharing data that was produced in the National Phenome Center. You will explain to us why you chose to do that. And the other one is about high fidelity data, and one of the main issues that everyone knows about in the field of metabolomics, that is this comparability, confidence in the data. How do we find methods or agree on methods so that we can all move forward in the field? So I would start with the open platform. So it's actually a preprint. You will tell us in a second.
Eternal preprint.
The eternal preprint, yes. So it's called An Open Platform for Large-Scale LC-MS-Based Metabolomics, and you're the first author on that preprint from 2022. And so to put it simply, you're releasing a lot of data that you generated with the group at the National Phenome Center in this preprint. So can you explain why you chose to do that? Because often people cling to what they've produced, and this is their intellectual property that they want to keep and maybe sell. So what was the drive to do this for you?
Yeah, so first of all, it should be noted that it wasn't my decision. It was the team's decision. The great group at the National Phenome Center wanted to do this. And in fact, it was a friend of mine's suggestion who worked there. His name's Gonzalo, and he said, you know, it would be really cool if we did this in this way. Everyone wanted to do this massive public disclosure of all the things that we had learned and all the things that we had pinned down over the preceding 9 or 10 years. And Gonzalo said we should do it as a preprint, and that would allow us to come back to it and revise annotations and things like that. And we thought that's a great idea. So before I left and moved to Bruker, the last thing we did was pull all this information together, right? We cited our other papers. A lot of it was already published, but some of it wasn't. And specifically, things like the SOPs, they weren't published. You don't publish SOPs in a traditional academic way. So we put them on GitHub, right? So all of the SOPs, which took really smart people a lot of time to compile. We had a wonderful person named Verena, who I just remember Verena spending days and days and days formatting, right? Weeks and weeks formatting SOPs, right? A lot of people involved, right? Everyone in the team was involved in building these things. That's a contribution. You think that's a lot of work. Let's put that out there. And then the annotations lists, right? Let's put those out there. In fact, let's put everything out there both as a return on the public investment that was made, right? But also, I think that was probably 90% of the motivation. 10% of the interest would be a little bit of an experiment, right? Because we talked about standardization and networks for years prior. And I always wondered, if the value was big enough, would people do it? Because I know people won't standardize through force. I know people won't just be told what to do, right? That's not how innovative, especially academic science, works at all. But I always wondered if the value package is big enough, will people adopt it, right? All the annotations and the methods and everything. And I think there's some evidence that it has been adopted, right? The labs recently opened using the same methods in Germany. But equally, I think such a disclosure may not be used to its fullest advantage by others in the field. So I think it's been interesting to see how that's impacted or not over the years.
Yes, it's a really interesting topic because, of course, everyone wants to learn and wants to also exchange, you know, the best of the methods or the best of what they've done. But it's also difficult, especially I can imagine when you've built your own workflow, to say, I'm going to change to something else. And I think maybe that's also where to some extent, I think the workflows or the methods that are provided or suggested by the vendors can feel like a bit limitations, because of course they're limited to whatever this group of people knows. But to some extent, I guess it's also driving a form of standardization in the field for the people who choose to adopt what has been developed in industry and then move from there to make their own version of it.
Yeah.
Is that a development that you've seen now that you've kind of worked on both sides?
There are certainly people who want to get going who say, please tell me how I can do this, right? In fact, that's an expectation of some customers. They say, I'm buying these systems from you. I'm buying into your ecosystem. I also want the methodology. I want to get up and going quickly. And that's one kind of enablement. That's you know, us and, of course, other manufacturers, everyone's trying to support broader communities of perhaps less expert users. So to be able to offer that is important, right? But the incentives for a lot of expert communities to just use what other people are doing, I don't think that it's really a complete set of incentives. We have to remember, especially in many academic labs, that reinvention of the wheel can get people master's thesis and can get a PhD thesis and can publish papers, right? So, you know, you have to take a step back and say, why does everyone use their own version of a reversed phase gradient, you know, for the last 20 years? Why are we suffering such small differences that only serve to undermine the value of communal resources? I'm thinking like retention time databases and things like that. I think that's a curiosity, something I've always thought about. I think at the end of the day, it's just incentive structure. If you believe in like the theory of incentive structure in Freakonomics, I don't know if you know the book, but it's basically people operate to their incentives. And if the incentives are more individualistic, I have to get my students through programs, you know, then that's kind of the way it goes.
Yeah, and I'm always wondering, like comparing metabolomics to genomics, for example. And I mean, 30, 40 years ago, genomics, like there were many ways to do genomics, transcriptomics also, like in more homebrew fashions. And then at some point, there was a crystallization of the technology that led to a more, you know, a higher throughput, a lower cost, and all those things that we haven't reached yet for metabolomics, whichever way people measure metabolomics, also NMR and so on, because we talk a lot about mass spec, but it's not the only way. But there's still this huge diversity in the way to acquire the data in metabolomics.
Absolutely. I think often that crystallization moment comes through parallelization. Right. Mm-hmm. So all of a sudden you're doing something in sequence one after the next, and all of a sudden you can 8-plex, 16-plex, and it just becomes overwhelming. The value becomes overwhelming. So people adopt it. Today, we're still, you know, running things one sample after the next, and some people run it faster and some people run it slower. But at the end of the day, someone said this, I can't take credit for it, but I love the saying. These analytical methods that we all use are like toothbrushes, where everyone has their own and no one wants to use someone else's, right? That's really, really true. And I get it from a human nature standpoint, but it holds the field back in terms of shared knowledge building on each other's. And of course, there are industries behind this as well, like the column chemistry industry is also like not incentivized to say, hey, let's forget all these chemistries and focus on just this one, right? That's never going to happen.
So we have to wait and see at what point metabolomics is going to have this crystallization moment and what happens there. I'm really curious because I think in the end, I know in my work also previously, I was looking a lot into, as we're going to talk about with the second paper, so this standardization aspect, this aspect of scaling, being able to scale the work, for example, for cohort studies or for exposomic studies. And for such large projects, this is really where these standardized methods will make a difference or are making a difference already. But let's move to the second paper. So this one is from 2021 with Caroline Sands as first author. You're the last author. And the title is Representing the Metabolome with High Fidelity, Range and Response as Quality Control Factors in LC-MS-Based Global Profiling. You discuss here basically data fidelity, or maybe now I would say, today I would say confidence also in the data, but as well as the quantitations. It's a perspective paper, so what was the perspective that your team wanted to push forward in that paper?
The personal interest in this, like go back to what I said at the beginning, Colorado State, working with Western blots, I was trying to quantitate them more than they ever should have been. And I remember people like Jennifer Nyborg saying, you can't scan and quantitate this qualitative data, right? This is kind of like that same thing 15, 20 years on, where we're looking at metabolomics data and we're seeing some of the weaknesses in it. Right, specifically around quantitative fidelity, and we're thinking, can we make this better? Like, can we just geek out and do a deeper dive and try to make this better? So this was effectively our COVID lockdown paper for Caroline and I, and again, mm-hmm. number of other wonderful people: Elena Chekmaneva, Maria Gomez Romero, Gonzalo, who mm-hmm. I mentioned previously. This was our lockdown geek out, right? And so that's, I think, one of the reasons why I love this so much. We would love to bring metabolomics into a more serious, reproducible analytical science. That's not to say it's not serious. I'm not trying to say that, but like, it is somewhat removed from pharma-based bioanalysis, which has strict FDA criteria. And so quality in metabolomics is usually a bit relaxed in order to enable discovery, in order to enable untargeted workflows and things like that. But does it have to be? And is there a better way to approach data fidelity and data quality? That's exactly what we were trying to get at here. And what strategies would we use to do that? And what tools do we have to do that? Pooled QCs, where do they really help us? And where do they let us down a little bit, right? So we explored all of those topics in an effort to just push forward the rigor. And I think one of the things that I really, truly value about it, there's a guy that I really like and respect in the field. His name is David Broadhurst. He's out in Perth. And he described it as great, but a bit too much. And I thought, that's perfect. That's exactly where we wanted to be with this.
It is great. And it's really like you really put a lot of thought into using real data to exemplify the points that you make. So I really encourage people who are a bit curious about maybe the philosophy behind what we do and getting the perspective, as it is called for that paper, of another team on how this work is done. But like when we look at this from the community perspective, for me, the question really is, how do we drive this? And of course, like you're not in charge of the community, so you don't have to have the answer for this. But from your perspective, and of course, your perspective with many years in core facilities, which is a special commercial form of metabolomics, and now in a private sector as well, how can these parts of the community help? Because they have this kind of high sample volume, so like measuring probably more samples than other users of metabolomics in a single year, or enabling the measurement of more samples in a single year. So surely this can lead to some form of, you know, making it more standardized, easier. So how do we do this from this angle to enable the scientific community to do what they want to do, not just to tell people this is what you're going to do, but rather to say, what is it you want to do? And we're going to help you with that.
Two concepts I think are super important. Like I said earlier, the value mm-hmm. has to be there. Otherwise, there's no incentive to adopt. And in fact, people mm-hmm. will, in my experience, push against standardization in favor of individuality. Mm-hmm. I think there's very reasonable reasons and very much mm-hmm. human nature oriented reasons why they would do that. But if the value is enough, they will adopt, because they'll say, well, gosh, I just don't want to recreate that, right? This is going to mm-hmm. advance me 2 years, 3 years, 10 years, whatever it is. And they will adopt mm-hmm. and they will standardize. That's one aspect to it. The second aspect is fit for purposeness. Okay. And this is something that we thought about very, very much at the National Phenome Center. I mean, one could argue, why did we reinvent the wheel, right? We totally sure. reinvented the wheel. We reinvented mm-hmm. the methods ourselves. So we're completely guilty of that ourselves. But we did that in order to serve some needs that weren't really conventionally met at that time. So, mm-hmm. for example, we wanted to perform high volume analysis. We weren't focused on high throughput. We were focused on high volume. And what that meant was we wanted instruments running 24/7 without interruption. And in order to do that, we actually had to make some methods longer. So a 96-well plate will run exactly for 24 hours if the method is exactly 15 minutes long, right? Mm-hmm. And so we actually made things longer in order to make our operations more efficient, if you think about mm-hmm. that. Because at the time, we were using maybe 12-minute methods, and we really quickly ran into the fact that you don't get on a good cadence. And if you're not on a good cadence, mm-hmm. you have people coming in the middle of the night, or you just have wasted time. I remember visiting one mm-hmm. lab who remained nameless. The person showed me their amazing high throughput system, which was based mm-hmm. on technology with two well plates in the auto sampler. And I said, well, what do you do when those are done? And they said, well, it's done, but that's, I can run this many samples a day. And you thought, well, why do you run them so fast if the rest of the day there's nothing running? You know, like that isn't fit for purpose, right? So I think often there's too much focus on throughput, which always seems to have a negative impact on data quality, right? The faster you go, you know, of course, we try to develop technologies that mitigate that. But in like, you know, chromatographically, the slower you go, the better things are. There's just diminishing returns with going faster and faster. So sure. I think just remembering that your approaches should be fit for purpose. If you're doing large volume analysis, by all means, make it high throughput, but not to the point where it undermines the quality of what you're trying to achieve in the first place.
That's really interesting. And that brings for me the question of how do you figure out that value and the purpose that is needed? So how does a provider of technologies or of solutions know what to build for the field? Is it a coincidence or are there communication channels? Can you tell us more about this?
Our collective ears are open to the community, and the community can effectively steer the ship in many meaningful ways, right? In many meaningful ways. I think the job that we sometimes discuss is trying to look through or past what people say they want and try to really interpret what they need to be successful. So there's a little bit of an interpretation step there. People may say, I want this. And if you hear that enough, you may think, what are you really saying? Oh, you're actually saying that you need this to be successful. And that's so you know, there's a little magic, there's a little work to be done there. It's not just direct one-to-one, oh, you want this, we'll deliver this. But ultimately, the field is at the helm of the ship, right? And and what we the best thing we can do is design innovative solutions to fill unmet needs. So making the unmet needs known, coming together and saying these are critical unmet needs, and then letting industry or industry academia partnerships innovate to fill those. That's kind of the name of the game. I think that's the important good way forward. And in terms of the value, like the magnitude of the value, I think you have to be willing to give certain things away. You really have to be willing to say, we'll help you interpret your data more or interpret your annotations more. We have to be able to help people in that way in order to drive progress, I think. And that goes for the whole community. That's not really an industry-only perspective. I think everyone has a role to play in that. Industry, academia, networks, collaborative networks, core facilities.
Yeah. When you look at the metabolomics community today, I'm sure, I think we all have our perspectives of like our pet projects or the fields that we think and know metabolomics will be helpful with. When you think about the future of that technology, where do you see it being the most relevant in 5-10 years, being optimistic that it's not going to take too long for it to become hyper-relevant?
Yeah. I love the field and what it promises that it can achieve. Like I really, and by promise, I mean like the idea, the kind of boundless possibility. I really like that. So for me, some of the most interesting applications are in naturally harder to reach areas, using metabolomics to help with brain sciences, brain being a naturally fairly inaccessible organ, right? And so, you know, okay, like we can all take blood and that's one thing, but like for prevention, diagnosis, prognostics, treatment, guided treatment, especially of diseases and conditions that are hard to pin down any other way. Like the mental health aspect, the chemical signatures of mental health, for me, that's like a really cool thing that where metabolomics can potentially give us a lens that is otherwise very hard to find. There just isn't another way into these types of diseases and organs. I think that's interesting. For me, the forever frontier is exposomics, though. Really, I think the world around us is chemically changed more than we can possibly grasp. I think truly that one of the most exciting things we're doing as a technology innovator is that we're providing systems now which are able to shed light on how, on the extent to which that's true. Driving this kind of age of realization around, oh my gosh, there's PFAS in the water, there's PFAS in the air. And every time we burn wood, there was a paper recently where we're just releasing lead back into the air from wood that's, I don't know, presumably absorbed it over decades of leaded petrol use, right? I mean, it's just every new paper on this topic is an oh my gosh moment. It's really an enlightening moment. And I think we need to keep driving technologies that enable this, that enable us to do that, and then link it back to human health, right? That's why, I mean, it's the forever frontier, because the chemical diversity that we're pumping into the environment is massive, and its influence on endogenous metabolism, human biochemistry is always going to be a study, right? So I don't think it's a final frontier. I really think it's a forever frontier.
Yeah, and it's also a closing the circle frontier in a sense, because especially when you do metabolomics with mass spec, it's actually the same or similar methods you're going to use to measure the exposome. So you can use parts of the knowledge that you've built studying metabolomics, lipidomics, and then expand that to look at both the exposure and the impact it has on an individual or a group of individuals with similar or parallel measurements. And this also, exactly. I think, from the perspective of the technologies and building those technologies, there's a lot there that can be leveraged. They don't have to reinvent the wheel again when you do exposome. Like, you go look at different chemical classes, but you know already how to do a lot of it.
That's true. Yeah, that's true. I think it all comes down to getting the sample in, right? So whether you're, you know, humans can be reduced to liquid extracts pretty easily, you know? But, you know, there's other things, right? There's certainly air, which is an area where we're moving into now. And that all that is just like a different sampling technique, different ionization techniques, and different frequency of sampling. I think that's a big thing as well, right? The metabolome is very dynamic, can be very transient, but the air is like super transient, right? So you actually have to have sampling techniques that are more what in that field they call high time resolution, right? So yeah, it's all variations on a theme, fit for purpose. I think it comes back to whether the technologies are fit for purpose.
So are there any other aspects of the metabolomics community or your work that you would like to discuss?
I think one of the most interesting things that I've seen in the last 5 years or so is how data quality unifies broadly long-time established expert users and novice researchers, especially a shout out to the MQAC consortium. Those calls are amazing, right? You have this equal footing for big names and for people just starting out. And I don't know, it just seems like this really great, healthy, unifying topic, which brings people who may otherwise not be working together. So I've loved seeing that. I think what the MQAC guys are doing is just incredible. I've loved being a part of it, but it's really community driven. There's no single person at the helm, which is itself interesting. It seems to work really well. So I don't know. I think, you know, if you're listening to this and you're not involved in that, get involved in that, because it's really cool. I can't think of many other things like that that have had that kind of impact in bridging people. And it's just good to see, in an era of reproducibility crises and everything, it's good to see quality being in focus.
So this brings us to our last question, our usual question. What's your favorite metabolite and why?
I think my favorite, in terms of the one that I've thought the most about or worked the most with over the last years, would be cysteine.
Why cysteine?
Well, back in 1810, I think it was 1810, there was a paper by, I hope I don't mix these things up, William Hyde Wollaston. Now, you know this is off the fly because you just asked me this question.
Yes, right? Yes.
William, William Hyde Wollaston had a paper on a kidney stone that was of an unknown composition back in 1810. In the very, very early 1900s, by that point, they had understood that it was made of a material called cysteine, right? Mm-hmm. Cysteine, very insoluble in water, and that's why it was forming kidney stones in the urine of people with certain inborn errors. And in fact, cysteineuria became one of the original inborn errors of metabolism described by Archibald Garrett in 1905 or something like that. Mm-hmm. And that kind of history and the curiosity around that is really interwoven into my very early desire to understand biochemistry more. And there's a very long story around that, which I won't get into now, but that was very impactful in terms of how chemistry has direct impact on life and human health, and opening the idea of inborn errors of metabolism, which really brings one into an appreciation for the impact of metabolism. And you can see from there how one may become enamored with the whole thing and take off in a career studying that, right? Trying to elucidate that. But like, what an amazing amino acid disulfide bridge is important for protein structure, important for all different types of chemistry. Glutathione reservoir is an important concept in metabolism, and it's all because of cysteine disulfides, right? That's really to me. I don't even frankly know how to say it properly. Is it cysteine? Is it cysteine? What do you call the disulfide?
You're asking me. You're the native speaker.
Versus the monomer. Yeah, I don't know. These are things we write a lot, but don't talk about.
I don't know. Yeah.
Yeah, two cysteines. One of, there's an extra E in one of them, right? It's all kind of fascinating, I think.
Both from the chemistry and from the spelling point of view. Thanks. Yeah.
Thanks.
Thank
Alice.
You for being on the podcast today. It was lovely to speak with you.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this episode of The Metabolomist, where we explored one of the many communities that leverage metabolomics for the greater good. To make sure that you don't miss out on our next episode, you can follow the podcast on your podcast app or go to themetabolomist.com and register to our newsletter. Until then, I wish you to get to use metabolomics with the same passion and the same dedication as my guest today, and don't hesitate to reach out to me on LinkedIn at Alice Limonciel with your thoughts on today's episode.